Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, tune into a conversation between Jonathan Latham, award-winning author of The Fortress of Solitude, and Stacey Williams, whose book Bizarro Worlds references Latham's characters and storylines to explore racism and gentrification. This conversation originally took place March 15th, 2019, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
So I could maybe start and say how this portion happened, how we're like sitting here today, which was basically that I was just sitting at my computer and got an email from Allison, who works here, and said, yes, Jonathan Latham has read your book, and he would really love to sit down and talk to you. And then maybe I yelled in my office really quickly, and I forwarded the email to my husband and freaked out really quick, and then was like, oh my gosh, yes, that this little tiny book that I wrote would have made it made it across your path. I'm very flattered. Thank you.
I mean, I'm gonna have a little difficulty saying this without getting choked up, but I, you know, the most amazing things that can happen to you are the things you couldn't predict, that your own explorations or just your desires will lead you to write these books, and then that they land anywhere is always amazing. And then to have something like this kind of echo come back is the amount of excess in the reward, you know, that such a thing should exist.
Well, thank you. thank you for writing
thank
it.
Thank you so much for being remembering my book enough to write a book about it.
It was deeply compelling. So the question I have, because there was this point, this point made about it being semi-autobiographical, I feel like a lot of writers will say, yes, I've had these things happen to me and I should write about it. I need to tell my story. So like, at what point did you know that you were ready to write that story? And then, you know, what was the process, I think, of that memory extraction?
Yeah, that's a great question. So The Fortress of Solitude was my sixth novel, and I began writing in a spirit of, I completely foregrounded the imaginative act. I didn't think that I would write autobiographically, or I thought that anything that was autobiographical would always be inflected or kind of transmuted, and I would recognize it, but it wouldn't be the kind of thing that people would identify. And that just seemed natural to me for a lot of reasons. I grew up, my father is a painter, and I grew up reading comic books and watching films and looking at surrealist paintings and abstract paintings, and I always thought that the figurative, the surreal, the metaphorical, you know, a lot of writers, I think, before they write fiction, write things that are more direct, whether it's essays or they're in academic work and they write a thesis or a dissertation, or whether they maybe just write a lot of journals. I did very little writing before I tried to write stories. In a way, I came to writing weirdly through making paintings. So I thought of my books as kind of imaginative artifacts, you know, like, or sculptures, things you could kind of look at and give you, they would give you feelings, but they weren't testimony. But of course, language isn't like a musical note or a color on a canvas. It actually has this trapdoor of content, you know, kind of baked into it. And the minute you begin telling any kind of stories, no matter how little you might think they have to do with you, they are autobiographical. But I was dedicated to the idea that there was no reason to get any closer to the autobiographical gesture than that. That the accidental and the compulsive autobiographical nature of my work was enough. And I certainly didn't think I was going to write about New York City. I was living in California in my 20s when I wrote my first four and a half novels. And I moved back to Brooklyn And the first thing I did was write this sort of Valentine to Brooklyn in the form of Motherless Brooklyn. A very exuberant book that has to do, the energy in it has to do with rediscovering the kind of the vitality of street language, the way, something I'd missed living in California, honestly, was East Coast kind of sardonic vibrancy of the street encounter. Yeah. And I identified with it, and I found a metaphor in Tourette syndrome that was a kind of a way of writing about that and exaggerating it and heightening it. But the autobiography in that book was still very indirect. Mm-hmm. But in doing that book, Motherless Brooklyn, which was in a way of a piece with my non-New York, my imaginative fantasias, my early novels represent, I started to accidentally name the world that I was from. I put the characters, almost inadvertently, I put them on the streets of my neighborhood in Motherless Brooklyn. They were going to bodegas and walking past grade schools that I'd gone to. And this was pulling feeling out of me, and much, much richer and much more ambiguous and challenging feeling out of me that I was naming these places. So in a lot of ways, I think of it as beginning with street names that I sort of tricked myself into this space where I would write something that was autobiographical. I'm still avoiding the word direct because actually one of the things reading Bizarro Worlds made me think about was how much, even as I play the card, you know, this book seems to I'm pointing at your book. Fortress of Solitude seems to confess, okay, this is who I am and this is where I come from. And yet I used a lot of sleight of hand. I guess the habits of the imagination had become so essential to me. They were the only ways I could even get to the material. So, you know, I know the ways in which the book invites and very meaningfully, very reasonably invites people to identify, like Dylan, mm-hmm. the main character, with me. And I know I'm in there. But I'm also not in there in a way, or I'm in Mingus, mm-hmm. his best friend, as well. And my brother is in both characters, and several of our friends are kind of, it's like each of those two boys is a kind of weird vehicle or container for a lot of guys I knew growing up, mm-hmm. Different aspects of them. And then again, the neighborhood and the events are transmuted in various ways. But reading your book, because you're identifying your own experience so directly, not with mine, because mine isn't on the page, but with Dylan's,
yeah.
I sort of started to see a triangle, like you, me, and Dylan, and this kind of interesting triangle of identifications that was really rich for me. And it reminded me of writing the book, to see you thinking about it that way.
Well, that was the thing that I did find so compelling. I went back to the book because I knew I wanted to write about it, but I hadn't read it in so long. So I went back to it and I reread it as I was writing the proposal. And I had just been so sure that while there were these things that I could recognize that Dylan and myself were probably very, very different or had led these different lives. But then when I started seeing the parallels, that was almost uncanny to me. And it started bleeding into these other things that I was writing where I guess I just had like a voice in the back of my head saying, you have to tell the truth. Don't forget to tell the truth. It would be very easy not to, or it'd be very easy to draw myself as being in opposition to this character who maybe did have like problematic things happening, but seeing that there were parallels there that I could not really run from, that was really kind of a turning point to me. So I had started writing. I had written the proposal, and I had a full first draft. And I'm sure, as you know, you get that first draft back, and your editor is like, please try again.
You make reference to this in the first line of
yeah,
the book.
Yeah.
The evasive version that you...
Absolutely. Yeah. And when I read back that first draft, it was like, oh, wow, I think I had completely... you know, there were maybe things that I had experienced or you know, things that I'd heard or things that I had lived or seen that I had put so far in the back. So I think going back to reading Fortress of Solitude, it very much helped to pull that out. And I would also add, you know, when you talk about language and how being back in Brooklyn really pulled that out of you. That's one thing I love so much about the book, the musicality of the language.
Thank you.
Actually, this isn't the first time that this book had even come up for me either. So a year before I even was asked to do the proposal, I was in a writing class, and the instructor said, bring to next week's class a scene in a book that you think is just really rich and alive in terms of feeling and movement. And I chose the scene when they're in the hardware store trying to steal the graffiti, because the language there was so rich. It was like you had dropped us completely into one of the boys' phrases of speech. And that was also, you know, I noticed that going back and forth in the book, we have these very different narrators looking in on these aspects of these boys. Sometimes it is Dylan, sometimes it's Dylan first person, sometimes it's Dylan third person. But that scene, I don't even know who the omniscient narrator really is, but it's all of the boys, and it's so alive. Like that scene crackled to me, so I let it start to finish.
Well, thank you, and you're giving me a really great opportunity and reminder to describe a feature of both the process that got me to the lucky place I got to in that, especially the first half of the book. So I'd physically moved back to the neighborhood where I'd grown up, and I was also more in contact suddenly with other kids from the neighborhood, and I, you know, didn't, it just sounds really stupid, like a acceptance speech or something. I didn't do it alone. I sat for hours and hours with my brother, Blake, and with Lynn Nonage, talking with my friend Dione, learning how it looked to them, triangulating experiences that I'd never spoken of before. All of us naming things. My friend Carl describing experiences that we'd had and comparing notes and, you know, kind of creating this holographic image of the street in, you know, 1975 and 1976 and feeling it again, but not alone, with their collective help. And so some of that polyphony, you know, I specifically conceived the first half of the book as a kind of chorale of voices. The way it shifts, I mean, it's, you know, in literal terms, there are points of view. There's even, you know, Isabel Wendel's point of view, and Abraham's point of view comes in at some point. But beyond that, that kind of slippage into a collective, transcendental, you know, voice of the street that's kind of looking at everyone was a reflection of the fact that I'd had to gather so many voices to bind them to my own vision in order to think about the place. And it also, you know, gave me a metaphor for what was wrong with Dylan afterwards, is that he switches to the first person and he has no chorus around him, you know.
He's alone. He's alone at that point.
Yeah.
And he's gone so far away from Brooklyn.
Yeah, he's without... and that's also why the thing is conceived as a so the secret, you know, dumb metaphor for the entire book is that it's a box set of a singing group, right? And in the first like 2.5 discs of the 4 discs, they're together and you love it and their voices are all together, and then you get the solo careers and you're like, well, that's stupid. You guys belong together.
You belong together. Absolutely. So this is interesting. You went back to the block. Was your process very different once you had actually gone back home versus when you were, you know, you're writing in California and touching on other genres and whatnot? Like, how did that change when you actually returned?
Well, I mean, I was just growing as a writer so much, and I could not, you know, along with deferring the autobiographical material and feeling completely unready to think about New York and coming of age there, I didn't have the, you know, to speak of the kind of the dumb creative writing instructor's word, I didn't have the craft. I hadn't read enough of a certain kind of book to handle my own impulse to make a book like Fortress of Solitude. And it wasn't until, and in some cases it was reading, in some cases it was rereading. I mean, the Keystone books for me, in terms of thinking about how to do all the voices I wanted to do in this book, were Baldwin's Another Country, which I had read as a teenager, and Christina Stead's The Man Who Loved Children, both of which are crazy books structurally. They don't obey any law except the emotional necessity of their telling. They both unfold with a kind of broken structural logic where characters surge to the foreground and take over, and you know them because it's time for you to know them. And I wasn't ready to be so disorderly until I'd really take, you know. And another one that was helpful was Call It Sleep by Henry Roth. From Call It Sleep, I borrowed this fundamental metaphor that, you know, the kid is in a relation to the life of his family where inside their house they speak Yiddish, and then he's thrown out onto the, he goes down the stoop and onto the block, and the kids are speaking American street English to him, and it's rendered as this weird, like, grunting sound initially. And this idea that the life of your inside your house and the life the minute you go through the front door are two irreconcilable, incommensurable experiences, and yet you have to straddle them. You're doing that
because it's home,
right? Exactly,
it's home. Yeah. That, so actually, yes, with home, I also looked at Another Country. As I started writing, I mean, I think I was looking for a lot of different voices, but I also wanted to make sure that I wasn't privileging my voice over these other experiences. I mean, like you say, they're the sum of a lot of these different interactions that you might have, or the sum of your various experiences out in the world. So while I was reading, you know, I went back to Another Country. I actually went back to Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc's Random Family. I read that and Fortress of Solitude around the same time. So it was like getting these very different portraits of New York. And I think at that point I had not been to New York yet. So those New York stories loomed very large for me. Baldwin, also a New York writer. So that might have actually been even more about my process in terms of seeking out these different New York voices. I'd even taken it back to A Tree Grows in Brooklyn just to really get that historical kind of sense. What did this neighborhood look like, you know, at the turn of the century?
You know, the tree in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn is the ailanthus tree, which yeah. I'm obsessed with in the Fortress of Solitude. But I didn't know that when I started writing the book.
That's such a great
so
story.
The thing about Another Country also is that, you know, such crucial experiences happen to you when you're a young reader and you are innocent of context and you immerse yourself in a book. And when I read the first 50 pages of Another Country, and I thought I was reading an entire book that was about Rufus, and then he jumps off the bridge, and I never recovered. I read the rest of the book, but I never recovered. And of course, no one in the book recovers. And that's been a model for me forever of the way a book can fall off a bridge. And the idea and a life that life involves loss that is, you know, the presence of someone's absence, because the entire book is about, and you know, it's 500 pages after him. And I was like, wait, was it a trick? When's he coming back?
Like, no. Yeah, he didn't come back.
You know, and that also permitted me to write about loss, to have the audacity to have, you know, Rachel vanish from the book and never be recoverable. But the pressure of her absence is, you know, is a consummate experience. I hope. It's to me, it's... She's always there after she's gone.
She's always there, but I mean, it is definitely one of those things that's formative, I think, for Dylan. So I think what also resonated with me was this idea of him sort of always in motion, always moving away from Brooklyn, kind of running away from Brooklyn. So even around the time that I had done this, I was on perhaps my fourth or fifth city in 6 years or something. So
you were running.
There was a lot of running, actually. You're right. There's something about that innocence. There were so many things that I had not yet experienced or just didn't necessarily have the language to use in processing those experiences when I first read the book.
Well, and the names that you're offered are insufficient names. Beginning, I think, with the word gentrification, which is like, it's one of those words, I think about this category a lot, words were offered for things that don't really exist.
Yeah, they don't mean what, they don't mean enough, or
multitasking. There's no such thing. I mean, computers can do it. People just switch. There is no multitasking.
Yeah, it's really, that was the truth too. It was like, what am I actually writing about if I'm simply talking about the process of these neighborhoods changing?
So, reading your book, I was thinking so much about what it was to grow up with this word that was offered to be against or for, and I could never orient around it. You know, and as a child, I always had such bad conscience about gentrification because everybody I knew was on one side or the other of it, and I was somehow always wrong. Mm-hmm. I always felt wrong. And then I realized, actually, it's the word is trying to name something, and it's lying about it by naming it the way it does. That either it's much more intimate, you know, it's individual encounters, or it's, you know, capitalism. It's what's wrong beyond. You can't carve out, you know, 8 or 12 blocks and call it Borum Hill and then argue about what happens inside that container without looking at the space of American, you know,
absolutely,
the histories of housing development and white flight and all of these things that are so immense and that the, you know, lining up on one side or another of whether or redlining.
Yeah, yeah. I think in writing that was also the part that was maybe a little gutting for me because, yeah, again, there had been this innocence around the time that I first read The Fortress of Solitude where, you know, I had a sense about what gentrification was supposed to be. And I was sitting there living in a neighborhood that was gentrifying. I mean, it was peak gentrification. It was like an artist work loft. There was a pottery kiln in the basement, and it was affordable housing, but it was still very much in this vein, in this largely Latinx neighborhood on the south side of Milwaukee. But when I went back to it later, I think the thing that I felt so gutted by was this idea that, you know, you can tell yourself or you can believe that you're a very good person, but you are making decisions as a part of this system that are almost preordained.
One is always a participant.
Yeah.
And exactly who you sell a house to or rent a house to or from,
yeah,
and or from what happens in that space, you're enmeshed in a story.
Absolutely. And I mean, that was also what I found was interesting, too. Once I realized what the truth behind that story was, then listening to how other people would frame their participation in that system. Because, yeah, as you said, we are all participating, I suppose, unless we go to the desert like Charles Heist, live out with the hippies and the rabbits and the bears. That's really the only way that you could consider yourself as outside.
Well,
and
when you actually go to the desert, you realize
that
there are legacies and histories and invisible gentrifications going on and, you know, dispossessions. They're in those spaces as well. I mean, the fantasy of an American free, open space is a fantasy. It's the founding fantasy, right? It hides the original gentrification fantasy. It hides a genocide before it hides a gentrification, right? Yeah. So that is the myth, and you know, and it was alive. The idea of an urban frontier, you know,
and still is. I mean, yeah, there were there were people we totally knew in Lexington who would be like, we're pioneers. We got to this neighborhood. It's like, you got to this neighborhood in like 2011. Lexington was, you know, a city like going back to the 1700s. So yeah, just this idea of even how people spoke about their presence in different neighborhoods and what it meant to amplify, what it meant to erase. And then you can't unsee it, I think, was the thing that I really got out of both the books when I went back to the Fortress of Solitude. There's so many things that Dylan tried so hard. He couldn't unsee these injustices. Maybe that was why he had to go. Yeah. That's interesting. So I want to ask. I'm doing a lot of asking.
It's a lot.
It's the journalist in me. I apologize.
Yeah,
genre. So yeah. You are, and I would add that along with more contemporary people now, like Eve Ewing or Roxane Gay, who, you know, you are writing across genre, which I've always admired so much. I think as a much younger writer, there were a lot of people were maybe telling me, like, well, if you're going to write this, you have to stay in that lane. If you're writing fiction, you're always writing fiction. Or if you're writing detective novels, you are always writing detective novels. You are not allowed to branch out. But yeah, seeing your work across genres, I'm a huge science fiction fan myself.
Yeah, nods and comic books.
I love it. Yeah, and comic books. So like reading something like that, or seeing Colson Whitehead write Zone One, which is one of my favorites. How do you approach crossing genre, or is there a difference?
Well, yeah, I have so much to say about this, and it's so many different nested issues. I mean, talk about another word that's like tells too many stories to be one word, right? I mean, genre can mean formal patterns or form, you know, poem, essay, novel, short story. When I grew up, it was seemed like a category in a library, the spinner rack on 4th Avenue and Pacific Street at the library that had the colorful science fiction paperbacks on it. I was like, that's for me. I like that spinner rack. So that seemed really simple. And I immediately found that I was actually most interested in the stories that were interfering with the pattern. You know, when I would read, and you know, it was in some of that was even emblazoned on the books. People would, you know, I discovered Raymond Chandler, and it would immediately say, "Well, he's not really a crime writer, or only a crime writer." And I thought, "Well, what does that mean?" And so the energy for me is always in the interference pattern, the boundary, the limits of what people mean by genre, and. I really liked writers who showed me where that edge was by fooling with it or performing some kind of trickster operation where I thought I was reading one kind of thing and it changed, and so I just wanted to do that. I just thought that's the higher sport in a way, and I was lucky, I think. When I came along, there were these amazing examples like Ursula Le Guin and J.G. Ballard in science fiction, or Patricia Highsmith, Shirley Jackson. I loved a writer named Thomas Berger. Did he make your 100? Oh, he should be up there. He's so good. Well, who kind of made a practice of transforming themselves with each book. And I thought that was what I liked about it was that they were also helplessly themselves. They would turn out to be the same writer in different disguises. It was like a costume play. But also, I think some of this comes from my training in the visual arts, where, you know, all painters, it seemed to me, from walking around museums and going to galleries with my dad, including my dad, who was a painter, had periods, and their work was different at different times. And even within a given show, you didn't understand them by looking at one painting. It was the constellation of the rooms in an exhibit and the different faces that the different paintings had added up to a kind of a you know, like a kaleidoscopic or constellation kind of sense of what this person had to say. It's one reason I always felt I had to write a lot of books, not just one book, because I had the gallery in my head. I wanted there to be different faces. And, you know, the writers I liked were different at different times. Mm-hmm. So genre was a vehicle for trying to, you know, express this appetite for difference.
I love the painter analogy that, yeah, you could... It's not going to be what you know about a writer from just that one book, but maybe really the sum of the work and those different periods and how you as the reader are interpreting these things at very different points in your life. I mean, so that's always the thing that I would say before, that a good book is supposed to deepen over time because we're always evolving, we're always thinking, changing, growing, and something will hit you differently in your changing period than it would have at any other time.
That's
so
right. Yeah.
I do. I love writers who play with genre. It's so exciting, and it makes me feel as a writer that there's just so much possibility, really, that there's so many options that I haven't thought about yet.
So I can't help hearing that maybe you're working on some fiction, Stacey.
Working on yeah. some fiction. So I had my first short story published last year. Thank you. And thank you. So yeah, the things that you said about place really resonated for me in terms of, you know, something that looks semi-autobiographical. So it was a short story around it was a short story basically just about a guy who runs into his ex at the mall. And of all of the elements of this story that I think people might have been like, ooh, is that the autobiographical part? the part that actually I was building that out of was the mall. It was very much in my head. You know, growing up in Milwaukee, there are actually some Milwaukee people in the audience. So the mall in my head was Grand Avenue Mall, which is a mall downtown. And, you know, most of our malls these days they've died or they look really different, especially in cities like Milwaukee or in cities like Cleveland. What used to be the mall that you remembered as this grand place, you know, you go into them now and they're shells. So really I used the mall as the vehicle to tell the story, and this guy is remembering all these things that were grand, like in the way that you used to remember a mall, but you know, really there was not anything there.
That's great. That's great.
So yeah, working on short stories, but I did just start something that could be sci-fi. I haven't decided yet how fully deeply I'm going in there, but just seeing these great writers doing that, it's like, yes, let me try. I love that form.
Dynamite.
My final question, I must know, DC or Marvel?
Oh yeah, it's funny. So the title of the book, right, Fortress of Solitude, seems to align so powerfully with Superman. But I always found Superman unbelievably embarrassing. And it was like Marvel was the world you wanted to be in, and DC was the world you might get stuck in if you were too nerdy and boring. No, Marvel all the way. Yeah.
Marvel all
I just,
the way.
You know, I'll tell you, I'll brag now because you'll dig this. I just wrote a one-page, so Marvel is, I guess it's they're coming up on their something, 50th anniversary or some kind of celebration of themselves.
60.
They're putting out some kind of gigantic coffee table book, and they're asking a lot of people to write one-page pieces.
Exciting.
And so I just wrote a one-page comic about Black Bolt for Marvel.
That's so exciting.
With my two little boys.
Awesome.
Yeah, they were very excited. So they're working. I got my kids hired by Marvel. Of course,
that is,
it's a work for hire contract, which is not a good example.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. On that note.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. We will be taking a short break from releasing new podcast episodes, but we'll return in 2022. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.